From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 1 week ago, Wednesday, September 10th, the day after the Democratic primary in the state of New York. Fordham Law professor Zephyr Teachout lost in her bid to upset Governor Andrew Cuomo. Her performance, roughly 34% of the vote, stands as one of the greatest performances by a challenger to an incumbent during a primary. But a loss is a loss, and the next day, reporters wanted to know, would she endorse Governor Cuomo? Would her opponent, I should say, would her running mate, Tim Wu, endorse his opponent, Kathy Hochul, on the lieutenant governor's side? Well, so far the answer has been no. But Teachout came out almost immediately and said she would put her energy not into helping Andrew Cuomo, but in helping Democrats get elected in the state Senate. Now, that might not seem like a significant story on the face of it, but in fact it is. The state Senate is ruled by a hybrid coalition of Republicans and breakaway Democrats, and that has had an impact when it comes to what kind of legislation passes, what kind of legislation stalls, what kind of legislation has no chance at all. For Republicans, the goal for November is to either keep that coalition, preventing Democrats from full control, or to win the Senate outright. Zephyr Teachout wants to see Democrats win it outright. And when we say Democrats, we mean Democrats that would pledge to rule as their own leading coalition, not breaking away to join Republicans. And Teachout says that will impact women's health issues, immigration issues, taxes, and more. Recently, Laura Namias, a reporter for Capital New York, wrote a detailed piece explaining all of the moving parts here. And we're glad right now to welcome Laura to Connections. It's worth laying out the landscape in that our Senate, our state Senate here in New York State, is not necessarily constructed in a way a lot of Senates are in terms of kind of a ruling coalition. And that was a big point of contention between the Working Families Party and Governor Cuomo. Give me a sense for the landscape as we head toward the November election.
Well, for the past 2 years, the Senate has been ruled by a coalition government that is made up of Republicans and a five-member conference of breakaway Democrats known as the Independent Democratic Conference. With the so-called mainline Democrats, there are fewer of them in the minority. What that means is that no substantial legislation can pass without the sign-off of the Senate Republicans here in New York State. And Governor Cuomo is thought to favor that arrangement. He's a fiscal conservative, so to speak, or more so than other Democrats in the state. And he likes working with this group of leaders. But he promised, as part of a deal to get an endorsement from the liberal and labor-backed Working Families Party in May this year, that he would push for those mainline Democrats who are currently in the minority to win enough seats this fall to retake power in the state Senate. So essentially committing all of his friends and allies in labor and a group of people down in New York City, including New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, to help push for that outcome, putting money, get out the vote efforts into helping the Democrats retake the Senate.
All right, so you've got Bill.
So that's where we're at now. It's a mouthful.
And you've got Bill de Blasio, very active. Even though he's New York City mayor, he's become a big figure in the progressive movement. He has been active in trying to push for, in his words, a real Democratic Senate. You've got Zephyr Teachout not endorsing the governor, but saying her efforts are going to be toward, in their words, taking back a real Democratic Senate. And after the governor made that promise to the Working Families Party, how active have we seen him? Has he matched Mayor de Blasio and Zephyr Teachout, or has he retreated again?
Not at all. What we've seen is, and we've seen him, he hasn't campaigned or dedicated any of his substantial campaign funds, personal campaign funds. He has over $30 million in his own so-called war chest at this point. He hasn't given any of that yet to help the Senate Democrats. What he has done and what his campaign will say is that they've been sending out his running mate, Lieutenant Governor candidate Kathy Hochul, to stump for Senate Democrats, and she has done so in very forceful language in the weeks leading up to the primary race. We haven't seen the governor come out and stand with any Senate candidates yet. We're not sure whether or not we're going to see that. And also, given the governor's performance in the primary race, where he was shown to be really unpopular with a lot of more liberal Democrats, it's unclear whether some Senate candidates in more liberal districts in the Hudson Valley, in New York City, would even want him out there endorsing them, given his relative unpopularity with some factions of the Democratic Party. So very little effort from him so far, and we're not sure what exactly we're going to see from him in the next couple of weeks.
Now, it may seem obvious to some and less obvious to others why this matters, but let's look at just a few of the reasons it matters. I think of, for example, the women's equality agenda, which has not been able to get out of the Senate, so it has gone nowhere. What do you look at in terms of practical impact of the way it is currently structured, the leadership of the Senate, and the way that could change if Democrats took back leadership, real leadership of the Senate?
Some of the biggest things that Democrats are hoping to see if they are able to retake the Senate would be some economic measures, such as an increase in the minimum wage, for example. This is a signature issue. The minimum wage was increased by legislation under the ruling coalition that's currently in power a couple of years ago, but Mayor de Blasio and other progressives want to see that minimum wage increased even further, and they also want to give municipalities the option to index it to inflation, allowing them to decide within a city like New York City to increase it by as much as 30%. And that's a huge issue right now. That's a huge issue for Democrats. They're also hoping to push for measures such as the DREAM Act, which would give tuition aid to the children of undocumented immigrants. This is a national issue, and there's a state bill pushing for this, and that failed earlier this year under the current Senate configuration. The women's equality agenda, as you've mentioned, is a big issue for Democrats in the state. And also, campaign finance reform is something that Democrats have been talking about, and especially the liberal base has been talking about for years, and it has been unable to pass in the New York State Senate. Issues like public financing of campaigns of all races, that is something that Democrats have said they would be able to enact if they had power in the state Senate.
We're talking to reporter Laura Namias from Capital NY, CapitalNewYork.com. Her work appears there, well, it feels like every hour, I would say close to every hour, just about every day, and especially as we are now finally in full swing of political season, it's become for a lot of us a must-read every day. Now, Laura, when it comes to the realistic outcome in November, Republicans are optimistic about not only holding this kind of a coalition, preventing a Democratic, sort of a pure Democratic takeover of the Senate, they are optimistic, as you have reported, that they're going to win a clear majority outright, and they've targeted some seats up here. Senator Ted O'Brien's seat is in play. He's being challenged by Republican retired news anchor Rich Funke up here. There's a few other seats in play. What is the most realistic outcome that we're seeing now?
We actually don't know. It's going to be, I think anyone who says confidently that they're going to win a clear majority or that they know what the outcome is going to be is a, you know, is bluffing. It's going to be very close, it seems. It will be a ground game of resources between the different camps, who can turn out the most votes, who can spend the most in any district. They'll be fighting for every single vote in every district, and trying to just strategically decide where to spend their money in the next couple of weeks to help increase turnout for their candidates. But it's both sides understand that all they need is to cobble together enough seats to have 32 voting members in a block, and that's all that matters. It doesn't matter where those members come from, whether they're registered Democrats, whether they used to caucus with Republicans, whether it's just a matter of getting enough people together to hold on to power, and that's historically been the case in New York State, and that's the single goal that everyone is aiming for. It'll be close, and I would say expect the next couple of weeks to increase in just nastiness and down and dirty campaigning as they fight for those votes to get the seats they need.
All right, a couple more points before we let you go, Laura. First of all, your colleague Jimmy Vielkind just reported on the uneasy marriage this election season between Governor Cuomo and the Working Families Party. We've covered that on this program. They sort of created the Zephyr Teachout campaign and then abandoned her and Tim Wu for Governor Cuomo after Governor Cuomo made the concessions that the Working Families Party wanted. And now, if the governor does not go out and really push for, in their mind, a pure Democratic Senate, and if things don't change, among many other things that the Working Families Party may be upset about, what does this say about their decision there, and could they easily come to regret that?
Well, if Governor Cuomo doesn't hold up his end of the bargain, there's not really much that the Working Families Party can do, which was one of the questions that people raised about the deal in the first place. He's already secured their endorsement. He's fended off the challenge from Zephyr Teachout, although she did perform particularly well. He indicated immediately after the primary race that he wasn't going to pivot to the left or see Teachout's performance as a rebuke of his moderate Democratic brand of politics. The WFP is stuck with Andrew Cuomo as the governor for the next 4 years, regardless of what he does to help them. So they were in a tough spot to begin with, and there's not really much they can do at this point, and there's not much in the way of retaliation or blowback for Cuomo if he doesn't support Democratic Senate candidates. Something tells me that he will be happy no matter what the outcome in November. He'll find a way to make peace with whatever coalition is in power and doesn't need to push that hard for any candidates one way or the other.
Right. And you know, I'll wrap up with this here. The governor has existed in, and I know this characterization will be debated by many, but you could say he's existed in sort of a political middle. I mean, he has been pretty socially liberal, even though he upset a lot of people who wanted more rigorous medical marijuana allowances.
Right.
And he has been somewhat conservative on the fiscal side. They've been focused on tax cutting for not only for corporate franchise tax, but also property taxpayers, essentially tax cuts on every level. And there's plenty of voters who would agree with that. So he's existed in sort of a political middle. And
right.
And Blake Zeff reported that he was instrumental in the creation of this hybrid coalition that rules the Senate that has prevented some of the more progressive policies from going through, progressive legislation. And one wonders why he felt the need to create this marriage with the Working Families Party, because he has said in an interview with the Washington Post, quote, "If you go left of the Working Families Party, you fall off the planet." Well, when I talked to one of their co-chairs, they didn't appreciate that. They said they disagree with that characterization. They disagree with him on many things. You wonder why he doesn't just say, I consider myself a centrist, maybe more socially left, maybe more fiscally central. That's who I am. I'm proud of the record. Let's run on it. And let's challenge Rob Astorino on that, as opposed to making this marriage with the Working Families Party, getting into a position where he may upset people if he doesn't keep promises in the next term. It just seems like somebody's going to be upset.
Well, our understanding is that this can be explained a lot by the governor's personality, that he couldn't forego seeking the endorsement of the Working Families Party because he wanted to have it, and he believed that he would be able to increase his own vote margin in the general election by getting all of those extra votes on the WFP line in November. He was said to be wanting to seek a landslide victory, margins even greater than the ones that his father, Mario Cuomo, won by when he was seeking his terms as governor, and that he just couldn't allow the endorsement to go by without putting his name on it. At this point, it seems that it may have been smart for him to forego it, maybe smart for both sides, although that's debatable. But it's not clear that it benefits either group very much that they entered into this alliance. But the past is the past, and he sought it, he made the deal, and whether or not he holds up his end of the bargain is remains to be seen.
Well, we hope that he'll come on this program and share more of his thoughts soon, though I suspect we will be told by his staff and many other observers these uncomfortable political marriages have been part of politics forever. Probably
indeed.
True, isn't it? Yes, indeed. Laura, great work. And for our listeners who haven't read you and your colleagues every day, just a quick, if you could, description of what it is that you guys do on a daily basis.
Well, Capital New York covers New York City and New York State politics. We currently have the largest bureau covering Albany politics and policy, including healthcare, real estate, education, energy, of any news outlet in the state. And we are, if something's happening, we're covering it. I would tell people to come check us out at www.capitalnewyork.com. We're a subsidiary of Politico, and we'll be gearing up for the general election and everything that is involved in that over the next couple of weeks, and hopefully making some must-read coverage for everyone who's interested in New York State politics.
Laura Namias, thanks for taking the time for us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Next on Connections, you might have heard that we're going to be talking to Gary Craig of the Democrat and Chronicle. Gary's been covering the story of a local man charged with offering aid to ISIS and threatening to kill returning American soldiers, among other things. We've had to move a few things around, and Gary's going to join us at 1 p.m. So next, this hour, we go inside the plot to poison the world's most expensive wine. Coming up in our second hour, we examine the link between a Rochester store owner and ISIS. The FBI used informants to track the owner's actions and plans. They say he was allied with ISIS. Reporter Gary Craig has the complete story for us. Then we'll talk to one of Heather Boyum's closest friends. Boyum was the teacher killed by two intoxicated drivers while riding her bicycle. An upcoming event honors her. It's all coming up next hour.
Can I change my health coverage under the Affordable Care Act?
Can I sign up for insurance through the marketplace if my employer's plan is too expensive?
How do I choose a plan for my small business?
WXXI and the Innovation Trail are looking for questions about the Affordable Care Act from people like you. Log on to WXXI.org and take a brief survey about your understanding of new healthcare policies, part of a new WXXI reporting series.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The most expensive wine in the world is a bottle of Pinot Noir from Burgundy, France, produced by a wine company called the Domaine de la Romanée-Conti and produced in a vineyard called Romanée-Conti. Now, I say the most expensive wine in the world. I'm talking about an annually released bottle of wine, and this one comes in around $3,500 to $4,000 a bottle. That's new. Aged Romanée-Conti, as you're about to hear, costs a lot more than that. Now, 5 years ago, a longtime criminal devised a plot to poison the vineyard and extort €1 million. That plot involved a fingerprint-free letter complete with instructions on where to leave a bag of cash in the middle of the night. French police in helicopters were searching the vineyard, searching the nearby forest, and right under their nose, they couldn't even see an underground chamber constructed by that criminal. For a while, the crime was kept quiet, but then Max Potter started digging into it. Well, today, Max Potter is the communications director for the governor of Colorado, Democrat John Hickenlooper, At the time, Max was a crime reporter, but did not expect his own life to be changed when he went to France to cover this fascinating and odd criminal scheme. Max wrote a book about it. The new book is called Shadows in the Vineyard, the true story of the plot to poison the world's greatest wine. We're glad to welcome Max Potter to Connections. Max, you were a crime reporter for roughly 20 years, and it sounded to me, the way you wrote your own story, you got a little burned out, and this story kind of fell to you at an ideal time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate assessment. I had just reached, just by, you know, I'm a big believer in fate, and I think the way I heard about this story is I was in Napa, California, unexpectedly, really, on a trip, and linked up with an old college buddy of mine, and the abridged version is it turned out that since the last time I'd seen him, which I think he was doing a keg stand behind a fraternity house, he had gone on to be quite a financial success and had taken just about every sommelier course you could take, short of master. And he and his wife had started their own winery and bought some parcels of, or leased some parcels of vines in Napa and Sonoma. But anyhow, he started telling me about how he had just heard about, well, he read on a blog about how some bad guys might have or might not have poisoned some or all the vines in the vineyard called Romani Conti. And I looked at him and I said, well, what's Romani Conti? And he started to explain to me what Romani Conti was. But just when he had told me about that, I mean, part of the reason I was enjoying my time in Napa was as he was taking me around on these tours, everywhere we went, you know, it just seemed like kisses and cupcakes, rainbows and sunshine. You know, people were making wine and loving every minute of it. And I had just reached a point covering and editing and assigning stories, essentially stories that had to be written, but didn't really give you a whole lot of reason to have confidence or be optimistic about your fellow man. And I was just at a point where I was thinking enough is enough already. And I had said to my friend Brian, who was the one who told me about the crime at Romani Conti, I was telling him this, and I said, I got to find a way to get out here and, you know, cover some of this sunshine and winemaking. And that's when he sprung it on me. He said, well, actually, I was thinking of a story to share with you, but I don't know how much kisses and cupcakes there's going to be in there, and you probably have to go to France. And so that's how it started.
And for our listeners, and frankly, most of our listeners, even who love or appreciate wine, might not be overly familiar with Romani Conti because most of us have never had the chance to drink a bottle. But give us a quick description of what Romani Conti is.
Sure. And by the way, I mean, I think it's not uncommon for most of the universe to not know what Romani Conti is. I certainly didn't until it was explained to me. Romani Conti is a vineyard. It's the crown jewel vineyard of the Domaine de la Romani Conti, which produces a handful of the world's finest wines, wines with names like Latache, Echezo, Grand Echezo, Romane Saint-Vivant, but the Grand Cru of all Grand Crus is Romani Conti, and it comes from a remarkably small parcel of earth, smaller than 5 acres square, and produces somewhere in between on an annual basis. You know, a yield could be as low as 2,500 bottles to as high as 6,500 bottles, which is a sliver of a sliver, it's a splinter of the wines that are produced in France. And the wines from, well, the Romani Conti wines, for example, the 2009 vintage, when it was released to the market, sold for about $3,500 a bottle. And as many in your audience know, that would be for the most recent vintage available, and the most recent vintage available is the least expensive, more often than not. A bottle of 1945 Romani Conti, not all that long ago, auctioned off for about $125,000 for a single bottle. So bottle for bottle, vintage for vintage, barring unusual context or circumstances, Romani Conti is the most expensive, rarest, and there's not too many critics that would say otherwise, the most spectacular wine in the world.
And it's Pinot Noir.
And it's a Pinot Noir, yeah.
And in this case, the crime was an extortion plot that involved a rather bizarre but seemingly potentially brilliant plan to actually poison the vines themselves. And I loved the way you told the story of this underground lair that the criminal had created. Give us a sense for, I don't think it gives too much away to say that's where this crime story starts. Give us a little bit of a sketch of that.
Yeah, so what happened is that in 2010, early 2010, Aubert de Villaine, who runs the Domaine de la Romanée Conti, received a note. And the note essentially said to him, your precious vineyard, Romanée Conti, is in the process of being destroyed. Some vines have already been killed, and other vines are marked. If you want to prevent your vineyard from being annihilated, stay tuned for another letter. And that sets off this police investigation. And, yeah, the bad guys behind it went to great lengths to execute this plan. For example, when the first note, when one of the notes arrived at Monsieur de Villaine's home, it contained an extraordinarily detailed map that he had to unroll. It came in, you know, one of the architect cardboard tubes that he, and so he unrolls this map, which he immediately recognizes to be a map of Romanée Conti. And the map that the bad guys mailed to him was more sophisticated than anything that the domain itself had that would keep track of any of their vineyards. And that's just one example of the lengths to which they went. And you cite the underground subterranean hideout that these guys built. And the Domaine de la Romanée Conti is in a small hamlet called Vaune Romanée, which is the center, it's the heart of Burgundy. And it's a very, very small village, and it's at the base of a hill. And many of the best vineyards are on this hill, and they get the best midday sun and best breezes. But at the top of that hill is a very, very dense forest. And in that forest is where the bad guys spent many, many months digging out the earth and framing out and constructing a hideout from which they operated. And as you know, they would say in the old dragnet shows, that's where they cased the joint. You know, that was their operating base. From there they went and they inspected the vineyards, observed the rhythms and flows of the people when they came and went, the vineyard workers, the vigneron. And that's where they kept watch over their plan and at night. So their plan was they were going to poison and did poison some of the vines, not only in Romanée Conti, but another pretty fancy Appalachian vineyard called Musigny, which is a Grand Cru, another extraordinarily fine and expensive wine. And what they did was is they poisoned some vines. And so and they had plans underway to poison several hundred more. And they would leave at night, and, you know, it's pretty dark in those vineyards. I mean, it literally is pretty difficult to see your hand in front of your face. There's no street lights here. You're in the middle of nowhere. And they would come down under the cover of night, and they would drill holes in the vine just beneath the soil surface, and drill the hole, and then they would inject the poison, and the poison would do its thing and take out the vines. And what's significant about this, Evan, is that, you know, we've all heard, whether we're, you know, passionate about wine or not, we've all probably come across a newspaper story or some sort of report where a crime in the wine world would be fraud. There's a recent one that was big news in a trial in New York wherein a guy was making counterfeit wines, essentially, you know, making fake.
Rudy Kernaiwan, right?
That's right. That's exactly right, Rudy. And, you know, that's been going on since as long as we've had wine. Negotiants who are wine brokers, when the market wasn't going their way, for many, many years, the unsavory types would essentially go into their little lab and make a wine and put a fake label on it and sell it as something that it wasn't. So that's been going on forever. And that's sort of a crass commercial crime. But what was interesting and devastating to Aubert de Villene about this crime, and to really to all Burgundians, is the notion of terroir, which is this idea, and I know you've written a book on wine there in the Finger Lakes, so I know this is all information that you know very well. But the notion of terroir is that each parcel of vines is its own microclimate, and meaning it gets a unique amount of rainfall, its soil composition is unique, sometimes it faces sun in the midday, sometimes it faces sun in the late day. It happens to be that Romani Conti is built, grows on terroir that used to be a prehistoric ocean, so it's infused with, according to geologists, it's sort of the confluence, really, of extraordinarily perfect geological circumstances. It's positioned really in and among terroir that is the finest in the world. And for Burgundians, the most sacred thing in the world, I mean, winemaking is their life. It's an ideology. It's a culture. People are either making wine, drinking wine, or recovering or preparing to do one of the other two. And in that culture, there's nothing more sacred than the marriage of the vine to the earth. And no Burgundian had ever conceived that someone would think to go into a vineyard, which is, you know, there's been this vulnerable pact between man and nature, between man and vineyards, for as long as there's been vineyards, that we all know that they're open, they're susceptible, they're vulnerable, but we come to admire them, we come to harvest them, and no Burgundian had ever envisioned that someone would go into this very vulnerable place, this very vulnerable symbol of our harmony with nature, and literally drill into the most sacred thing in their culture, which is where the vine meets the earth. And that's exactly what happened here. And later when I asked Aubert de Villene about this, you know, this is a guy now, he's in his mid-70s, and, you know, he's been around a block or two and thought that he had seen just about all a guy could see. And he never expected this, and he said that it, you know, shook his faith in God.
My guest is Max Potter. He's the author of Shadow in the Vineyards, and the book is the story of this crime, targeting what is really the world's most famous and sacred vineyard in Burgundy, France. The story in the book not only tells of the crime, but also what I really liked about this, and I should stress to our readers, is Max wrote a book that you do not have to be a wine lover or have ever tasted great wine to really sort of come to love and appreciate, because it's not only good storytelling, but it kind of takes wine and turns it into a human story. And it becomes a bit of a biography of Aubert de Villene. And I got the sense, Max, that, you know, you connected with Aubert de Villene, and this is one of the guys in the wine world that most of us can never even get to. I wonder how you even convinced him to let you into his world at length.
So there's two questions. You know, how did I get into his world, as you put it, and did I get along with him, and did we get along with one another? I'll try to be as brief here as I can, Evan, but... You know, I first reached out to Aubert de Villene for the piece that I wrote for Vanity Fair, and he had no interest in cooperating. And his primary reason for not cooperating was that he did not want to inspire copycat criminals for, you know, some of the aforementioned reasons. You know, that we all know that the vineyards are open and vulnerable, and in France, this crime was unprecedented, and he didn't want to do anything to plant the seed of this idea in anyone else's head. The other reason is he's just an inherently private, quiet man, and wanted no parts of you know, putting himself out for all the world to scrutinize and see. And the way I got access to him, at least for the piece, was pretty standard, straightforward reporting. You know, I called and I said, "Hey, would you talk?" He said, "I'll think about it." And then he said no. And then I communicated to him through an intermediary, a publicist and a family member, that I respected his decision not to cooperate, but I hope he respected my decision and my job as a journalist on an assignment for a magazine, that I was going to come to France and I was going to report the story anyhow. So that message was conveyed, and then I didn't hear anything. So I get on a plane and I fly from Colorado to Burgundy, and I'd never been to France before, didn't speak French, didn't know a damn thing about wine. And all of which was ignorance that truly worked to my advantage, by the way, because if I had known just how ignorant I was then, there's no way I would have even attempted to do that story, which led to this book. But anyhow, I end up in Vaux-en-Romanée, and I was with an interpreter who was an old friend who understands the culture and protocol of essentially aristocratic France. And she recommended that even though I had reached out to him and we had had those earlier communications, that essentially we knock on his door at the Domain. And for those who do understand the Domaine de la Romanée-Conti and who Aubert de Vilaine is, the idea of just going and knocking on the door of the Domaine de la Romanée-Conti and, you know, knocking on it is one thing, but getting someone to answer is another, and then having it be Aubert de Vilaine who answers the door is an entirely different thing. The odds of that are slim to none. But essentially, that's what we did. And he agreed. I said, hey, listen, I'm in town. I figured, you know, I should at least shake your hand, and we should make eye contact, and I just want to let you know that I'm here, and I hope you don't feel that I'm tiptoeing around in your backyard without letting you know this. So we had a brief chat, and essentially what it came down to was, he had, in addition to the copycat, he had two primary concerns. One was is that if I were to write anything on this, he was very concerned that the storied history that means so much to him, you know, this domain has been in his family for many, many generations, and it is quite literally regarded, as one Paris official, government official put it a few years ago, a national cathedral of France. I mean, this is a national landmark for France. It just happens to produce the world's most expensive wine. And he was worried that this history would not be given its due. The other concern that he had was is that he just is naturally cautious about, you know, how the domain is presented. And he just wanted to be familiar with my work. And I showed him a couple pieces of things that I had done. And he said, so let me get this straight. You're gonna do this story whether I cooperate or not. And I said, I mean, yeah. And he said, well, I guess we should talk then. And so that's how it, really straightforward. There's no, you know, romantic story behind how I began my conversations with him. It was just straight up reporting. But then, you know, for reasons, as you said, when we began this conversation, the idea that I was burnt out from covering crimes for 20 years and really wasn't feeling too great about, you know, what was happening in the world. I mean, we've just talked, you were just sharing with me two stories that have unfolded in your community about a police officer who was shot and some really wonderful members of your community who tragically died in this plane accident. And, you know, when you're in journalism and you cover these stories every day, all day, over time, you know, nobody's whining here, but it does take a toll on you. And I had just reached a point where I was wondering, I had a lot of, to be corny about it, you know, a lot of existential questions, and I was kind of fried. And really, when Aubert and I started to talk, that's kind of where he was, except the difference was he was in his early 70s, and, you know, I had just turned 40. And, you know, he comes from a very aristocratic, privileged background, although you would never know that from interacting with him. You know, he's the first to work in the morning, one of the last to leave, drives like a very cheap French station wagon, wears like dicky work clothes to the domain. He calls the domain the farm. And this is a guy who really doesn't ever need to be at the domain, but he's there every day. He's in the vines. He's among the workers. He knows them. He doesn't just act like he knows them. He knows them, and they're his family. So we have this guy from this aristocratic background with every privilege in the world, and that, and who has been born quite, you know, born into wine, and he's sort of the combination of sort of the Elvis and Pope in the wine world. I mean, this guy is the most revered figure in wine, regardless of country. And then there's me. I didn't know a damn thing about wine. I grew up in a essentially working class, working poor neighborhood in Philadelphia. I grew up drinking what was ever put on the table in front of me, and it was usually whiskey and Pabst. And so he and I would have these conversations, and I think we pretty much had this conversation outright a couple times. We were kind of in agreement that it was sort of fated for each of us to come into one another's world. And at one point he said to me, he also appreciated that I wasn't an enophile and that I wasn't there to basically just kiss his butt and try and get a free glass of wine. I mean, again, I didn't even know what these wines were when I arrived there. And he liked that. And the first Burgundy, the first Burgundy I had, you know, was a 2008 Latoche.
Good. I mean, let me just stop and say, come on, man. That's a that's an amazing way to enter the world of Burgundy.
Yeah, it surely is. You know, as one of the neighbors in town put it, she said, you have to she actually had a crush on Aubert. She was a woman in her mid to late 40s and just totally sweet, and she's a winemaker herself. And I would meet with these people in the town and talk with them, you know, because I ended up being their neighbor because I lived there off and on for about 2 years. And one day we were talking, and she said, you know, you have to understand that you learning wine from Aubert and spending this time with him, this is like a schoolboy learning physics from Einstein.
but let me – can I also say, Max, I mean this in a way that as a journalist myself trying to offer also a critical eye, there's a risk in the book that some may view it as you write in the acknowledgments, you want people to kind of be open to the magic of Burgundy and the way Burgundy affected you. And some people may say, boy, in some ways it reads like too much like PR for Burgundy. But I got the sense that it wasn't you just, hey, I'm in, I can taste these great wines, whatever it takes. You really believed it. I mean, it was at a time in your life where you were open to magic, as you put it. And for you, that experience was not contrived or PR. It was real, wasn't it?
Absolutely. That book was written from my heart. And, here's the thing. When you get paid to do a magazine article or you get paid to do a book, and your job, Kevin, I mean, we journalists, you get paid the same one way or the other, regardless of how the story unfolds, regardless of the tone you take, regardless of the approach it takes. And the only, at least for me, the only motivating factor in the tone that I took was to convey the essence of the truth that I found there. And I think, I'm a pretty cynical guy. Usually if I had been writing about you in the past 20 years, you don't want me writing about you. And I found a place that was full of magic, that did restore my faith in humanity, that, you know, the best example I can give is one of my early visits there. I ended up speaking with the winemaker of Dvogue, and that is the domain that has vines in Musigny, the other vineyard that's been hit. And I was asking this winemaker, his name's Francois Mier, and I said, Francois, how did you feel when you found out that your vines were a hit? And he said, I was furious, and then he went on to explain why. And he said, you know, before this crime, we in Burgundy knew that we were insulated almost entirely from evil. I mean, Burgundy and Vaughan-Romane, this is a sleepy, wonderful, beautiful community with very low crime rate. And Francois said, we knew we were insulated from evil. But what we also knew is because we were insulated from evil, we had a responsibility to make the most of poetry that God has given us and make the best wines we could. Now, if you had told me 5 years ago I would be standing there listening to someone say this in Burgundy, France, I said you should check yourself in a detox as quickly as possible. If you would have told me that I would be standing there and I would be leaving it and feeling the emotion emanating from this man and see it in his eyes and see his heartbreak and see just what this meant to him and what this meant to the community, I was surprised myself But when you find a place like this that is all that it's cracked up to be, it should be celebrated. And there are, trust me, there are things in that book. There's enough bleakness, and there's enough awful stories that are in the world. What's wrong with celebrating the ones that are pretty awesome?
No, I understand, and because I'm going to run out of time, let me just jump in and remind our listeners, Max Potter, the author of Shadows in the Vineyard, offers what I think is one of the really fair and almost tender looks at when you finally learn the criminal and their background. I was almost touched by the way Max handled that. So, but let me wrap with this question. When you write about wine, you do make people want to go out and get it, Max. And that's the biggest issue I have with Shadows in the Vineyard. Most of us can't go out and get DRC, man. I mean, you know, it's just their low end is $400 and the high end starts at $4,500, and that's just not attainable for most people.
Well, trust me, I'm not drinking that stuff anymore. it's way out of my price range. So, you know, look, I wrote the book in such a way, I hope, in terms of the winemaking and describing the wine in Burgundy. What I hope happens is that the stories of the people who make the wines that I wrote about linger with everyone who reads it, and that they come to realize that that same care and that same heart and soulfulness and commitment and dedication and family history that the Villain family and the Loire family puts into their wine, that's common in Burgundy. That's what vignerons think about when they get up in the morning and they lay their heads on the pillow at night. And as one of the sources in the book told me, all of these things that go into the wine, he calls them ghosts in a glass. And what I hope is that readers have an appreciation for the ghosts in the glass, and that when they buy a Burgundy, regardless of the price point, they think about these stories and they think about this place, and that information, that context flavors the wine that they're drinking regardless of the price point. And by the way, you know, if I can make a recommendation here, the two dominant, as you know, Evan, the two dominant varietals in Burgundy are Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. They take well over 90% of land vineyards in Burgundy, but there are others. And one of them is a varietal called the Aligoté. And it turns out that Aubert de Villain has his own domain in a community called Bouzeron, which is to the south of Beaune. And so he makes his own wines. And just one of them it's a Bouzeron Aligoté. It's a white, and I recommend it wholeheartedly. I buy case after case of it now. And the price point, you can get it per bottle somewhere between, you know, $25 and $32 a bottle. And let me tell you that Aubert de Villain and his team put the same care in growing and making those wines under his own domain name, which is A&P de Villain, as they do at the domain. It's just that the domain is in the pleasant circumstance of having the best terroir in the universe. But you can go out and get a bottle of that and enjoy a Burgundy Aligoté for a reasonably accessible price point. And just by virtue of the fact that Aubert's name is on that bottle, he could charge 5, 6, maybe 10 times as much than he does, but he doesn't. And when I talked to him about it, he said, yes, you know, we're aware of that, but the reason I make the wines here and price them the way I do is because I feel like everyone should have the opportunity to enjoy a wine that is made with this sort of care. So they're out there. And you know, Village, which is the lowest Village, well, actually it's regional, is the lowest in the hierarchy of Burgundies. It's regional, Village, Premier Cru, Grand Cru. And Grand Crus are the Romani Contis. And then, but the Village, you go into a wine store and you see Burgundy on there. You can find some good regional wines, and they're, you know, $22. And like anything else, you know, part of the joy of Burgundy is taking the adventure of exploring the wines. And as long as you're not dropping $400 a bottle on your adventures, you should be okay.
Congrats on the book, and thanks for taking us inside that world. You know, there are few books that read with the sincerity that yours comes with, and I think that means a lot for your readers. I read plenty about wine, and I learned a lot. We barely scratched the surface in this interview. I learned about the crime. I learned about Albert de Belaine. I learned about the history going back to the 18th century, and I appreciated all of that, Max, and I appreciate your time today as well.
Well, Evan, I'm grateful for being on the show, and I thank you very much for your kind words, and thanks. Pleasure to be with you.
Coming up next hour, Democrat and Chronicle reporter Gary Craig sits down with us to explain what's going on in the case against a Rochester store owner charged with offering support for ISIS. Is he acting as part of a group, or is he a so-called lone wolf? What do the charges entail? It's all coming up. Gary's got the story in just a few minutes on Connections.